Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's Tuesday, November 2nd. I think you had a test last time, right? You had a test and lecture last time, and it's all graded. Your grades are on Blackboard, unless you didn't show me a picture ID or you put your Scantron in the wrong pile. Then I didn't sort all the different piles out yet. So you're welcome to come to my office hours to check your test out, make sure it got graded correctly, and of course I recommend that you do that because you can also review the test questions and maybe learn something so when you take it the next time you'll see how I word stuff or how the test is laid out to make sure you don't lose points just for that reason and not because you don't understand something. Okay, anybody have any questions about anything? Somebody mentioned that they couldn't get access to a quiz. I don't know what section that was, but I'll check on that. Yeah. You couldn't get to it? Oh, okay. Well, I'll just double check, make sure that it's available for you guys to do. Okay. Yeah. Just follow me right after class and I'll double check your section. Okay. But maybe I'll check all the sections. All right. So we were talking about blood last time. And as a matter of fact, we're talking about this slide right here. And let's get it in the slideshow mode. Oh, you can't see anything? Oh, okay. Well, then I'll make sure that you guys can see something, too. Arrow options, visible. Yeah, one of the projectors isn't working, so let me do this. Yeah, that's the dim one, too, unfortunately. Okay. So remember, we're talking about whole blood. That's like the stuff when somebody jabs a needle in your arm and sucks out a bunch of blood. That's what we call whole blood. It's got everything in there, right? So when you have whole blood, make sure in your mind that you can break it down into its two major components, and that is the fluid part, which we call plasma, and then the other part, which is made up of formed elements, and that's just a fancy term for all the cellular stuff inside blood, all right? So and then the formed elements are made of red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. That's the only thing that should be in blood. All right, so then we're going to move on to hematocrit. That's an important measure of how healthy a person's blood is, and it is just the percentage of red blood cells that make up whole blood. So you get a whole blood sample and put it in a test tube or a narrow tube so you don't have to take out a lot of blood from somebody, set it straight up, let it sit overnight so that all the heavy stuff does what? Falls to the bottom, right? So all the formed elements are going to fall to the bottom of that test tube. Or if you don't have time to wait all night, you can stick that test tube in a centrifuge and spin it around. And this happens very fast, just within a minute or so. All the heavy stuff goes to the bottom. And so you can see in the very bottom of the test tube, we have red blood cells. And then kind of almost in the middle, we have a layer right here that's kind of creamy colored. We call that the buffy coat because of that. And that's where all the white blood cells go. And then on top of that, we only have plasmas, right? So including the buffy coat, these are all formed elements down over here. And what hematocrit is just the measure of red blood cells compared to what the whole volume of that blood sample was. Right, so if you were to look at this test tube and just look at the red blood cell volume, and not the buffy coat right here, but just the red blood cell volume, as a percentage of the whole volume right here, what does that look like to you? Does it look like 60%? 70%? 50%? Maybe you're right. It's even less than 50%, right? So it's like 40-something. So this volume compared to the whole volume is, you know, on average, about maybe 40%. In men, it's 41 to 53%. That's the normal range. And in women, it's a little bit less, 36 to 46. And those are the normal ranges. So I want you to make sure that you can calculate hematocrit. So I gave you a little question right here. And answer the question. Is the sample from a man or a woman? All right, so here's the whole sample. And 30 mLs of erythrocytes, 0.72 leukocytes, 4 mLs of thrombocytes. Right after centrifuge, make sure that you can calculate the percentage of red blood cells in this whole sample right here. Okay. And you can check with me during office hours or with your lab instructor. That just is a check to see that you understand what hematocrit is. So if somebody is anemic, right, if somebody is not producing red blood cells, then their hematocrit is going to be depressed. And then somebody has to figure out why somebody is anemic. What might there be? What might the reasons be? Somebody is anemic. So, okay, raise your hand because I hear everybody one time. Yeah, what might be one reason?
Low iron.
Low iron, that might be a good reason. So the production, the red blood cells aren't being produced, might be a reason. But what might be another reason? Maybe you're making a normal amount. But maybe you have a hemorrhage someplace in your body. Maybe you're bleeding someplace, right? You're losing blood. And that has to be investigated as well. Okay, because you don't want to be losing blood any place in your body, right? That might be due to a tumor, for instance, that's bleeding. So these are all things that are hidden that you want to investigate. All right, so let's go back to plasma, right? We said it's about 9% of the volume, and this is only the fluid part, so we're going to talk about things that are dissolved in plasma, right? And in particular, proteins. So these proteins can dissolve in plasma, and they're broken down into albumins, globulins, and fibrinogen. So I want you to understand what some of the basic functions of these proteins are in the blood. Albumin makes up most of the proteins, right? And it is just a solute. So it creates colloid osmotic pressure. So if you have a solution, and on one end of the solution is very concentrated in solutes, and on the other end, it's very lowly concentrated in solutes, meaning it's mostly water. Which way is water going to move? It's going to be drawn into the part that has solutes, right? Just because of there's a concentration gradient. So albumin is used to increase the concentration gradient of water so that in capillaries, water is drawn out of tissue spaces back into capillaries because there is a high concentration of solute in the capillaries, and so that helps bring water back into the cardiovascular system after it's leaked out at the beginning of the capillary, at the proximal end of a capillary. So if somebody is deficient in albumins, what's going to happen to fluid? It's going to have a tendency to stay in interstitial spaces. It won't be drawn back into the circulatory system, and people are going to swell up. We call that edema. Okay, so that's very important for stopping edema in people, for bringing water back into the cardiovascular system. Right? And liver produces albumin. So if somebody has liver damage, liver cirrhosis, then swelling or edema is one of the side effects of that because albumins won't be produced in the proper quantity. All right, the second kind are globulins. We said that they carry lipids around because lipids don't like to dissolve in plasma because most of plasma is water. And there are lipid hormones, and of course a hormone has to be distributed by the circulatory system. And so lipid hormones bind to globulins to be transported. We talked about that. And also, globulins make up antibodies. We're going to talk about antibodies today. Antibodies are molecules that can bind to harmful substances in your body that we call antigens. And all bacteria and viruses have antigens on their cell surface, so these molecules right here can bind to even viruses and bacteria and help destroy them. Right, so it's a part of the immune system. So, and those are what we call gamma globulins. And the last kind is fibrinogen. This is a precursor to what happens when you cut yourself. It forms a molecule called fibrin, and fibrin then is important for coagulation or stopping bleeding when a blood vessel is damaged. All right, so here is some important nomenclature. Whenever you run into a word that has an ogen as a suffix, it means that it is inactive. It's a precursor molecule, but it can be converted into the active form very, very quickly, and the active form is fibrin. So it's like a pre-hormone that can be activated very quickly. So for instance, if you lacerate yourself and you start hemorrhaging, you don't have to build fibrin de novo, which might take maybe a half a day to build the proper level of that protein in your circulatory system. Well, what would happen to you by that time? You would probably die, right? But since fibrin is ready to go to work, not in the active form, but in an inactive form right there, can be converted very quickly, then blood clots form relatively rapidly, and that preserves a lot of blood volume. Okay, so anytime you see OGEN, think of it as a reservoir molecule that's inactive that can be converted very quickly. Okay, serum is plasma with all of these clotting factors removed from it. All right, so what does it have? It has albumin, so it has the proper osmotic pressure, right? It could also have antibodies in it. So sometimes we give people serum that have antibodies to maybe some venoms that they were injected with by accident, maybe a rattlesnake venom or spider venoms, right? So they're given something called an anti-serum, right? And an anti-serum is just a serum that has antibodies in it that will fight those particular harmful substances in somebody. Okay, so those are the plasma proteins. Now let's go to formed elements. You got erythrocytes, leukocytes, and thrombocytes, right? And these are red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. Red blood cells look like this over here. They're biconcave. They don't have any organelles. They're completely filled up with hemoglobin. As a matter of fact, they have about 280 million molecules of hemoglobin in there. Yeah. It just doesn't have fibrinogen and maybe some other clotting factors. So yeah, but it has everything else. It has antibodies, and it has albumin, and it could have some glucose in there and the proper level of electrolytes that serum should have, the right amount of sodium and potassium and calcium and all that kind of stuff. But it just is lacking clotting factors so that it doesn't coagulate or doesn't produce any kind of coagulopathy, any kind of coagulation problems in the recipient that's getting it. All right, and the shape of these red blood cells is optimized because we want oxygen to dissolve in and out of the cell rapidly, and so one of the things that determines the rate of diffusion is the surface area, right? And when I say surface area, what should you be thinking of in your mind? I'm not sure I have talked to you about this in this class yet or not. Did I go measure that door over there with a ruler yet? No, I did that in anatomy, but not here. Okay. But when you think of surface area for exchange, just think of a doorway. As the doorway gets bigger, what happens? More people, right, it's directly related. More people can go through the doorway. If it's a tiny, tiny doorway, just a few people can get through it at a time. So as you increase the surface area, then diffusion, the rate of diffusion increases. It's directly related. Okay. Now, since a red blood cell doesn't have any organelles, it can't repair any damage, right? So protein synthesis can't really take place because it doesn't have a nucleus. Transcription can't happen. So if there is damage to this red blood cell, then it just lives as long as it can without repairing it, and then it dies. And as a result of that, red blood cells only live for about 120 days, and they die. Okay, so there are about 2.5 million red blood cells that die in your body every second. That's a huge number. All right, so in order, what's that disease process called when you're low on red blood cells? I mentioned it just a second ago. That's anemia, all right, that's anemia. So what's the process? How many red blood cells do you have to build in your body every second so that you do not become anemic? Yeah, between 2 and 3 million red blood cells every second. So those tissues, those are hematopoietic tissues, they're very busy every second replacing those old and damaged red blood cells. So over the course of a day, it's about 300 billion red blood cells that have to be made. Okay, leukocytes, that's a white blood cell, right? They do have cytoplasm, they do have a nucleus. They can move around in your body by amoeboid motion. That means that they're shapeshifters, right? So the microtubule system inside these cells can push the plasma membrane out, and they can squeak through little spaces between cells, right? They can crawl around in different spaces of your body. This kind of motion is called diapedesis. Diapedesis is when a shapeshifter changes its shape to move around inside the cell. And typically, unicellular organisms like amoeba move around by that way as well. So they don't need cilia or flagella for motility. The kinds of leukocytes that we have, we got these granular leukocytes that have granules in the cytoplasm. They have many lobes of the nucleus. The nucleus looks pretty strange. All of these, pretty much, you could break down into detoxifiers. These detoxify foreign substances or release heparin. And heparin is an anticoagulant. We're going to talk about coagulation in just a little bit. The other kinds of leukocytes are the agranular leukocytes, which are lymphocytes and monocytes, okay, which we see right over here. And these move around by diapedesis as well, and these are phagocytic. For instance, these lymphocytes right here, they and monocytes, when they bump into a bacteria or something by diapedesis, they can actually swallow and then digest when that vesicle fuses with a lysosome. And then even the monocytes sometimes will bring that debris into the immune system so that your immune system can be activated and learn how to recognize those bacteria. And when that happens, then these lymphocytes, a certain kind of lymphocyte then, learns how to make antibodies against those particular viruses and bacteria. So a lymphocyte is important because some of them produce antibodies that protects your body, and it also makes another kind of lymphocyte that can actually phagocytize harmful compounds. And these monocytes work by phagocytosis. They can leave the circulatory system as well, and when they do, they become something that we call a macrophage. So a macrophage is just a monocyte that has left the circulatory system and is crawling around in the interstitial space someplace. All right, then our last formed element here is a platelet. These have to do with stopping blood loss, right? These are the smallest of formed elements. They also lack a nucleus. They can move around by amoeboid motion. They come from megakaryocytes in bone marrow. So bone marrow is the place actually where all of these blood cells are produced. And in a blood clot, these platelets form most of the mass of a blood clot. Normally, okay, when a blood vessel is cut, these platelets right here release serotonin, and maybe we talked about serotonin because it's also used in certain parts of the nervous system, central nervous system, as a neurotransmitter, but it's also a signaling compound that's released by platelets that causes vasoconstriction of a blood vessel when it's damaged, right? And when a blood vessel vasoconstricts, less blood gets into that vessel, and then there is less bleeding as a result of it, right? So that's a way to instill hemostasis. And hemostasis is what? Is preventing blood loss. Hemo is blood, stasis is maintaining proper blood in blood vessels. All right, but they can also secrete growth factors to maintain the integrity of blood vessels, and just like red blood cells have to be replaced every second, other parts of your body, including blood vessels, have to be repaired and rejuvenated, right, depending on what their schedule is. And these platelets have to be replaced as well because they only live for a maximum of about 10 days. Right? So there's a high degree of turnover for platelets because, again, they lack a nucleus. They can't repair damage to themselves. Okay, so hematopoiesis is the process of producing blood cells. So it's a formation of blood cells from stem cells in bone marrow. So bone marrow is what we call a myeloid tissue. And marrow produces about 500 billion blood cells a day. So that includes white blood cells and red blood cells. And that kind of bone marrow is what we call red bone marrow. There's another kind called yellow, which is basically just a storage form for lipid. Okay. Now, and the fetus doesn't have a lot of red bone marrow, but these cells can be made in the liver. But then the job is turned over to bone marrow. So we have both red blood cells and white blood cells. The process of making red blood cells in particular is called erythropoiesis. Erythro is what? Just red, right? And poiesis is the formation of red cells. It's stimulated by a hormone called erythropoietin, right? And that's a pretty important hormone right there because your body has to build, what, millions of red blood cells every second. And it used to be that we could only get EPO from people. So it used to be hugely expensive. But because of genetic engineering techniques, that gene was discovered, was isolated, and then that gene was used to transform bacteria. It was inserted into a bacteria genome. And so now bacteria can make erythropoietin for us. So it's a pharmaceutical agent, right? Pharmaceutical companies use bacteria to make erythropoietin, human erythropoietin, and that's typically what we call EPO. So in a clinical setting, people don't say erythropoietin because you don't have enough time usually to say big long words like that. They just say EPO, but that also means what? That it's the genetically engineered drug. It's not recovered from some kind of living source. All right, and the organ that secretes erythropoietin is the kidney. All right, so you should realize that many organ systems in the body do more than just one thing. If I were to ask you what the function of the kidney was, you would probably say, well, it produces urine. Okay, but that's not the only thing it does. Right, it also helps maintain the proper level of red blood cells in your body. Right, so all of these organ systems have more than one important function. Leukapheresis, on the other hand, is the formation of white blood cells. Erythropoietin does not stimulate that process, but it's by other signaling molecules that we call cytokines. And we're probably not going to talk very much about what those cytokines are, where they come from, and how that's regulated, but that's a pretty important process. All right, so here is erythropoiesis. We said about 2 to 3 million red blood cells produced every second. They only live for about 120 days. Old red blood cells are removed primarily by two organs in the body, the liver and the spleen, okay? And bone marrow, to some degree, they're phagocytized and broken down. All right, so this is the process on the right. This is not an exam figure, so I'm not going to ask you to memorize all the different cells and steps in this process right here, but these are the cells that you find in red bone marrow. The stem cell is the hemocytoblast. What's the name of a cell that builds bone? Anybody remember? Osteoblast. That's right. So these are all builder cells, right? You see blast on all of these things right here. So at least you should know that a hemo, that means blood, cytoblast, this is the kind of cell that can produce red blood cells. All right, but when a red blood cell is broken down, we don't really want to throw all those components away. What might make sense for your body to do with a red blood cell? So here's a red blood cell. Ooh, that was a good marker just a second ago. All right, what does your body do with a red blood cell when it's old, when it's dying? Here is a red blood cell. Maybe this is a nice red blood cell. No? Okay, how about this one right here? Not too bad. All right, so here's a red blood cell. When it gets broken down, okay, it's loaded with what kind of compound?
Hemoglobin.
Yeah, so we got hemoglobin right here. All right, so what are the components of hemoglobin? We've got heme. That's a big organic molecule. And we have globin. And I'm not sure we've talked about what globin is, but does anybody know what class of biological molecule a globin is? It's a protein. It's a protein. And so what can your body do with proteins? It can convert it into amino acids. All right, and then what can your body do with amino acids? It's a building block for any kind of protein that your body needs to make, right? Depending on how transcription is turned on. So your body can recycle some of the components in hemoglobin to make other kinds of proteins in the body. So we don't want to throw those things away. Okay, and heme then can be broken down into iron. Remember Fe? Okay, and a compound called bilirubin. All right, bilirubin. So iron can be recycled. It can be used to make more hemoglobin. And bilirubin is excreted in the body. And it's a pigment. It kind of is a yellow color. And so when there is excessive breakdown in red blood cells in somebody, then sometimes they get that yellowish cast to them. The whites of their eyes are yellow. Their fingernails are yellow. Okay, as a result of that. Anybody know what that condition is called? That's called jaundice. Okay, so that could be due to a couple things, right? This process takes place in the liver, so if the liver is damaged, somebody might become jaundiced, or if they are experiencing a lot of hemolytic conditions for whatever reason, right, they can become jaundiced as well, when the liver becomes overburdened and can't produce the proper, that whole amount of hemoglobin that's being released in the body. So, for instance, when somebody's on chemotherapy for maybe some kind of cancer where the liver is damaged as a result of the chemotherapy, they might become jaundiced, right? Or if the cancer has metastasized to the liver and the liver is losing function, right, they will become jaundiced because of bilirubin coming from the breakdown of all of these red blood cells. And we're going to look at a hemolytic disease in a newborn in this chapter as well. And a newborn might become jaundiced, and that's one of the things that goes into that Apgar score. As soon as somebody's born, they're graded in terms of what their respiratory rate is, what the color of their skin is, okay, what the reflex activity is, to see how healthy that newborn baby is. All right, so iron can be recycled. Most things in hemoglobin can be recycled except for a part of the heme group. Okay, so that's the breakdown of hemoglobin. So that's probably, you should take notes on that. I don't have a slide on that. This slide right here doesn't show the breakdown of a red blood cell, all right, but this is having to do with the production of red blood cells, and that's what we call what? Erythropoiesis. And there are two organs in the body that can monitor oxygen. Well, there's more than one, but these two right here, the liver and kidney, and primarily the kidney, can monitor blood levels of oxygen, and when they start to decrease, the kidney releases erythropoietin, which is then put into the blood. And this is not an enzyme, this is a hormone. So it's a signaling molecule, and when it's in the blood, where does it go? It goes everywhere in the body, right? Because the circulatory system goes everywhere, and in particular to red bone marrow. This is a hematopoietic tissue, so it has receptors for erythropoietin, and as a result, that increases transcription and results in the production of an increased number of red blood cells. All right, so now we have an increased... So what part? How would you talk about an increase in red blood cells? What's that one term that we just started the lecture with? How would you measure an increased number of red blood cells in a whole blood sample? You would measure the hematocrit, right? You'd measure the hematocrit of somebody. So as the hematocrit increases, what happens to the oxygen-carrying capacity of the blood? It increases because, remember, you got about 280 million molecules of hemoglobin in each one of these cells. All right, so we have increased oxygen carrying capacity. This is the response. And what was the stimulus? Low blood oxygen. What's the relationship between the stimulus and the response? Do they add? Do they add to each other or subtract? They subtract. So what kind of feedback loop is that when they subtract from each other? A nice negative feedback loop, right, so that the proper level of oxygen is maintained in the blood, is carried by the blood, via the kidney primarily, releasing erythropoietin, which acts on red bone marrow to make red blood cells. So if somebody is anemic for whatever reason, and maybe they still have some healthy red bone marrow, that red bone marrow can be stimulated to produce more red blood cells by giving what kind of compound? Erythropoietin, right, but it's a genetically engineered form, you would call that EPO. So if they're given shots of EPO, right, then their red blood cells, their hematocrit will increase. And this is abused sometimes in athletes as well, because an athlete who is an aerobic machine, right, the more red blood cells they have means the more oxygen their blood can carry, which means that they can exercise to a little bit more of an extreme degree. Okay, and I think they probably check for EPO levels in some athletes to make sure they're not doping their blood that way. Okay. Now, but that doesn't work all the time, because what happens, what should the hematocrit be in a normal male? About, 45%, right? And if it goes up to 50, 55%, now you've got more cells in the blood. What does that do to the viscosity of blood? It gets thicker, and then what do you know about blood flow as the viscosity goes up? The flow goes down, so this is kind of a self-defeating mechanism in a lot of people. So if they take a lot of EPO, right, the viscosity of the blood goes up, which actually does what? It decreases oxygen delivery to a tissue and can actually harm them. So this is a dangerous thing to play around with. Right? So I don't think anybody in here dopes up with EPO to increase their athletic ability, but don't do it. Okay, so we're going to move on and talk about some things that all cells have on their cell membranes, and those are antigens. And remember, there's one So this is, it has to do with immune response to protect yourself from foreign substances. And as a result, there are different blood groups. And there are different antigens that can be found on the surface of red blood cells. And so this is really important because every once in a while, or some people might need a transfusion due to hemorrhage, right? They might need a transfusion. And there are only certain individuals that can donate blood for transfusion. Okay, and that is what we call blood typing. All right, so there are antigens present on red blood cells, and these antigens have a particular shape. And there are, for the ABO system, there are two kinds of antigens. There's a shape A and a shape B. Okay, so depending on what you inherited from your parents, you could be one of four different blood types according to what? The ABO system right here. All right, so let's just draw a red blood cell. And let's pick a good marker that works. I'm not sure if I turn the lights on if that would help or not. What does that one look like? Maybe right here. All right, so even though this thing right here is blue, what is that? It's a red blood cell. Okay. And on the surface of red blood cells, not all, but some, there can be antigens poking up off the cell membrane. And somebody discovered one antigen that had to do with the clumping of blood cells during a transfusion. And so that antigen, they just called A. So it has a little, particular shape. And let me make the shape, make it like that, make it a nice sharp hat on the top. So that's an A. All right, so that's an A antigen. And where do you find it? On the plasma membrane. And it's going to have a number of these on the surface of the cell. I don't know how many, thousands, hundreds of thousands. I'm not too sure. So then the investigators kept working, and they found another antigen, but it was a different one. Right? It has a different shape. And so guess what they call it? B. All right, so here is antigen B. And here is a cell that has B's all over the top. And then they kept looking around, and then all of a sudden they found red blood cells that have actually both antigens. Right? It has both A and it has B antigens all over the place. Okay, so through just nomenclature, this is the kind of blood that we call blood type A. Right, so person with blood type A has these antigens that have this particular shape. Now that shape is not an A, it's just a particular shape. And then this would be blood type B, right? And this would be blood type AB. But there's one last blood type. Some people don't have any of these ABO antigens on them, all right? And so somebody's kind of scratching their head saying, well, we have one group was A, right, the second group we found was B, and now we got this third group over here. What would you call something that doesn't have, what's the letter of the alphabet that has, that has no antibodies on it? And so somebody was thinking, oh, it actually should be zero, right? There's one, two, and zero, but zero doesn't really work with letters. And so somebody just said, oh, I got an idea. Let's just call it O for zero. All right, so this is blood type O right here. Okay, so that's where antigens are located. And in this particular system, all right, it's not true for all blood groups, but for this particular system, you're born with these antigens, and you're also born, depending on what blood type you are, with antibodies in your blood to protect your blood from foreign substances. So a person with blood type A is not going to make an antibody A. It's going to, that person is automatically going to make a antibody B, right, so that it will bind to these antigens on the B red blood cell. So what does an antibody look like? Okay, it has like two legs that come down over here and two arms that come up like that. And then there are some receptor sites on the ends of these arms like that. And the shape of these receptors have to match what? The shape of the antigens over here. So what would the shape be if this one here is anti-B, right? Can't be anti-A because it would bind this red blood cell. What would be the shape of this receptor? Okay? It would kind of look something like that, right? And there would be another one over here. So this B could fit in that site, and this little guy could grab onto that particular antigen. All right, now a person with blood type B, what do their antigens look like? All right, these arms, here's the receptor sites right here. All right, so it's going to look something like that. And can you see the B, oops, can you see that the B won't fit into this receptor site right here? And again, how would you explain binding of an antibody to an antigen? By shape, complementary shape, right? Okay. All right, so this person right here, blood type B, is going to make anti, just automatically make anti-A. All right, now what about an AB person? Can they make any antibodies at all for either A or B? No, because what's going to happen, okay, if there are antibodies, for instance, let me draw that over here. If we have two red blood cells, and let's just say that this is a blood type B person, all right, so here's a B. What can happen? You can have this antibody, and it's going to grab this B, and this arm is going to grab this B, and now what do you have? You have these two cells linked together. And if there's more antibodies, then it will link together what? More cells. So thousands of cells eventually will get linked together, and when they get linked together, right, then the membranes are destroyed, and all these cells lyse, right, destroying the cells. So that's how antibodies can clump red blood cells together. All right, so with the AB person over here, there can be what? No anti-A's or B's. So this person here has no antibodies, but now with the blood type O, what do they have? Both. All right, so they got both anti-A and anti-B. And you just automatically start developing these antibodies. So blood group systems like this, this is a pretty easy to, I don't know if you've read that chapter yet, but it's pretty easy to figure out how it works. Okay. So on the test, I might give you, oh no, I'll save that for in just a little bit. Okay, so let's see what the next slide is. Basically, this is what I've shown you on the board. The antigens, what do you got to remember? The antigens are located on the surface of the cell. And antibodies are located in the plasma, right? And so they're just a solute in the plasma. They're dissolved in plasma. And when there's a proper match between an antibody and an antigen, these cells get linked together. This process of linking cells together is what? An antibody-antigen reaction that we call agglutination. All right, so the big word is agglutination. But I want you to remember the fundamental process, and that is what? An antibody-antigen reaction. And that's going to produce a transfusion reaction in some people. So this is what agglutination looks like. It's just a clumping of red blood cells and then the lysis of those cells. Blood type O is what we call a universal donor because it lacks A and B antigens. Right? It doesn't have any anti-A or anti-B. The recipient's antibodies won't agglutinate the donor's type O red blood cells. Right? And AB is what we call the universal recipient because type AB doesn't make any antibodies. Right? And so that won't agglutinate any of the donor's red blood cells when that happens. All right, now in real life, we only transfuse under normal circumstances in a hospital of the exact blood type to the exact blood type. Okay, because there's not only the ABO system, but there are other antigen antibody systems involved as well. Right, so it's not just a blood typing for ABO, but it's a nice cross match of other kinds of antigens that might be on the surface of a red blood cell. One of the other kinds of antigens is what we call the Rho D antigens that produce the Rh factor. And probably all of us have heard when somebody's given us our blood type, the ABO system, but whether we're positive or negative, and that has to do with another system of antigens on red blood cells. Okay, and it was first developed in a rhesus monkey model, and I think that's where that Rh symbol came from. And so you're either Rh positive or Rh negative. Unlike the ABO system where there are two, there is only one antigen. All right, so if we look at all these red blood cells right here in terms of the Rh system, what designation would we give for each of these cells right here? Like, do you see the Rh antigen on any of these cells? No, right, I only see ABO. So these would all be negative, right? So this would be what, a B negative blood type. This would be an A negative blood type. This would be what, an O negative blood type. But for instance, if it had an Rh antigen, okay, so I'll just put that, it has a little bit different shape, what would be the blood type of that person right there? That would be O positive, right? Or this person right over here would be A positive. And this would be still, what, B negative. So just think, the blood type that you are is determined by the antigens that you have on the surface of your red blood cells. Okay, now the Rh factor can cause problems for fetuses. Okay, and it can be a problem, for instance, if the mother is Rh negative, is like this, and the baby is Rh positive, right? Because the mom can produce anti-Rh. She can produce antibodies against the baby's red blood cells as a result of that. So how might that happen? Well, we said, what, the fetus has to be Rh positive. The mom has to be negative, but how can you have a fetus with Rh positive, with Rh antigens on the cell surface, if the mom is negative? That's right, because there's another person involved. All right, if the dad is positive, then the fetus has a 50-50 chance of being positive or negative, right, 50-50. Okay, so if the fetus has antigens, it is possible for the mom to develop these antibodies that kind of look like what? Okay, there's going to be like, what's an R look like? Something like that. So little receptor sites on an antibody that can bind to that particular shape. And so the fetus's red blood cells will clump together, will agglutinate, right, and then hemolyze, releasing what? If one red blood cell hemolyzes, releases what? About 280 million molecules of hemoglobin into the baby's circulation. But that just doesn't happen one time. It happens what? Oh, millions of times, right? So you got millions and millions of molecules of hemoglobin being released, and the poor little baby's liver is being overburdened with all of that heme, so they become jaundiced as a result of that. So it's a very easy condition to observe right at parturition, okay? But hopefully you want to prevent that from happening. Okay, and it can be prevented because the mom can be given antibodies against that antibody. It's called Rogam, and then the mom doesn't produce the anti-Rh antibodies, and the baby then is born normally as a result. So when that reaction does take place, it's called hemolytic disease of the newborn, or erythroblastosis fetalis. Right? So hemolytic disease of the newborn and erythroblastosis fetalis is the same thing. All right, so that happens when antibodies cross the placenta, causing hemolysis of the fetal red blood cells. The only other thing that you should probably know about this process is that the Rh antibodies are produced in a very dissimilar fashion compared to the ABO system. The ABO system, if you're blood type A, you automatically start making anti-B. Or if you're B, you automatically start making anti-A. But if you're an Rh plus blood type, you don't automatically make anti-Rh, okay? And so a mom who is Rh negative here usually experiences no complications during the first pregnancy because the mom can't make anti-Rh antibodies yet. But during parturition of the first pregnancy, there is usually some mixing of the maternal and fetal blood, and the mom becomes sensitized to the antigens on that fetus's red blood cells. So during the second pregnancy, since the mom is now sensitized, her immune system now can identify those antigens, the second pregnancy is in jeopardy. Okay, so usually the first pregnancy, there's no complication whatsoever as a result. So a mom will only produce anti-Rh after she's been sensitized to that particular antigen. Okay, so what kind of process are we talking about right here? The clumping of red blood cells. What's the name for that? What do we call that? The clumping of red blood cells? Agglutination. Yeah, agglutination. And what kind of reaction is agglutination? It's an antibody antigen reaction, right? Which is going to be different than preventing blood loss, which is what we call coagulation, right? So I do want you to know some of those terms. So agglutination is an antibody antigen reaction due to antibodies in the plasma, which bind to antigens on the cell surface. Okay, so let's talk about another important function of blood. Any questions on the ABO or Rh factor? So I could give you a red blood cell on the test. You could tell me what blood type that person is. And you could tell me what kinds of antibodies they have in the plasma, right? Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Okay, another good question is, what happens if the mom is blood type O and the father is blood type A and the fetus ends up being blood type A? What does the mom automatically produce if she's blood type O? Anti-A. How come we don't have to worry about that mismatch? How come only for the Rh system and not the ABO system? Okay, because these antibodies right here for A and B are big. They don't cross the placenta. Okay, but the Rh antibodies are small enough, they can actually go across the placenta. Okay. All right, so now let's talk about preventing blood loss, which is hemostasis. And so that's the cessation of bleeding when a blood vessel is damaged, right? So you don't bleed unless there's a blood vessel that's damaged someplace. All right, there are two processes for hemostasis. The first one is platelet plug formation. This works for very small tears in blood vessels, maybe microscopic tears. All right, and then for more major tears, there is fibrin formation. And fibrin formation is, the term for that is coagulation. So I want you to know the difference between agglutination and coagulation, two different things. So agglutination is due to what kind of process? Agglutination is due to a antibody antigen reaction. But coagulation is due to a different process, which is fibrin formation. Fibrin formation produces coagulation. This is for large tears. Okay. And let's talk about platelet plug formation. Here we have a blood vessel. All right, so I see the lumen of the blood vessel, and here we've got some nice red blood cells, and there's platelets going through here as well. And then there's some connective tissue that helps anchor this particular blood vessel to its surroundings, or this just might be some connective tissue within an artery or a vein. But remember, every blood vessel has a lining. What kind of tissue covers a surface or lines a cavity? That's an epithelium. Yeah, so here we have an epithelium that's lining the inside of a blood vessel, but we don't call it an epithelium, we call it an endothelium because it's lining some interior space of a blood vessel. And what kind of epithelium does that look like? Or what kind of endothelium does that look like? A nice simple squamous epithelium, right? And these cells are secreting compounds into the blood all the time, okay? And one is nitric oxide. So here's nitric oxide that's being released, as well as prostacyclin. Here's prostacyclin that's being released. And these compounds right here keep clots from forming. And nitrous oxide and PGI2 can also act as vasodilators, right? That keeps a blood vessel open. There are other kinds of compounds that are on the surface of these cells. Here is a compound that can metabolize ADP into AMP. So it's going to chop off one phosphate, right? And because ADP is going to be important for our platelet plug formation process. So ADP is going to get destroyed right away by this CD39 compound. It's just an enzyme on the cell surface. All right, so this is a nice undamaged vessel. But when there is vessel damage, right, we rip the endothelium, okay, then these platelets right here bump into collagen molecules that make up this connective tissue, as well as a von Willebrand factor right here, all right, and that is going to release, it's going to produce a lot of ADP, and it's going to produce another different kind of prostaglandin that is thromboxane A2, and sometimes we just call it toxic A2. That's released, and that's going to cause platelets to stick together, all right, and these platelets then are going to release more TAXA2, right, and they're going to release more ADP, which is going to cause more activation of platelets. So this is what we call the platelet release reaction. And these platelets, when they bind to this area of damage right here, that's going to block the leak, and that's going to prevent blood loss. Okay, so collagen stimulates that when platelets bump into collagen, and it only happens when there's damage to the endothelium. Okay. The serotonin that's released from platelets is going to cause vasoconstriction. And when this blood vessel vasoconstricts, less blood can get into this vessel, so that means there's going to be less hemorrhage as well. All right, so these things cause vasoconstriction as well. All right, so serotonin and TAXA-A2 stimulate vasoconstriction, reducing blood flow to the wound. ADP and TAXA-A2 cause platelets to become more sticky and attached to each other. And so this is what we then call platelet plug formation. And this is for what? Very small microscopic tears in blood vessels. All right. Now, for more major kinds of damage to a blood vessel, the platelet plug formation can't stop when a whole blood vessel gets maybe severed, for instance. Right? It can't stop the plug from that particular damage. But nonetheless, platelets are important. So platelets then work with fibrinogen to trap red blood cells. And that forms a big net over the wound to that particular that wound, and then the fibrin and platelets contract, forming that constrict that particular wound. All right, so here is a slide that shows how fibrinogen, which is, what can you tell me about fibrinogen? Yeah. It's inactive, how it's converted into fibrin. Now, should this be a fast process or a slow process? Fast, that's right, because don't forget, you're bleeding. Okay. All right, so it should be a fast process. There are two pathways. There's an intrinsic pathway and an extrinsic pathway that we're going to look at in a second. Okay. And when we look at this intrinsic pathway, I want you to kind of just scan through this really quickly and look for an ion that's necessary to prevent blood loss. Do you see an ion in there? Calcium. Okay, so again, probably everybody thought in anatomy that calcium is important for making bones. But what else do you know about calcium? It's important because it keeps you from bleeding to death. It's important for synaptic transmission so that neurons can communicate. And of course, it's important for cross-bridge cycling, right, so that muscles can contract. But here's another example of why you need proper levels of calcium, because of blood clotting. All right, so let's look at a diagram before we look at this slide right here. All right, so here's a nice graphic that you see in your book. And basically what I want you to take home, a couple important messages from this slide right here. Coagulation is the formation of what?
Fibrin,
right? So all of this right here, all these complicated pathways are going to result in the production of fibrin. And maybe on the next slide, next slide right here, this is what fibrin is. All right, so fibrin is a protein molecule that precipitates out of solution, forming what? Like a net, right, a meshwork, a net that grabs hold of platelets and red blood cells and white blood cells that forms a clot, All right, so here is fibrin. So we want to see how fibrin is formed. Okay. And it's a three-step process. All right, the first step is prothrombin activator formation. The second step is thrombin formation. And then the third step is, well, we want fibrin formation. And when we look at these pathways right here, what do we see? We see calcium is necessary. Right, some phospholipids are necessary. Where do you get phospholipids from? A plasma membrane, like for instance when it's damaged, right? So that's important. So this is important that you see calcium right here is necessary for proper blood clotting. And what else do you see? We see one reaction, okay, stimulating another reaction, which stimulates another reaction right here. What do we call that when there are a series of reactions or a series of enzymes that become activated that activate other enzymes that become activated? Okay, we call that a cascade mechanism with different levels of what? Amplification. So for instance, when this factor 10, which is what I call prothrombin activator, right, it's basically an enzyme that converts prothrombin to thrombin. It doesn't convert one molecule of prothrombin to thrombin, it converts what? Thousands. So there are levels of amplification in this kind of nasty cascade that you're looking at right here, which means what? This is a process that can happen very rapidly because of this cascade mechanism. All right, so it's not meant to be complicated it's meant to what? Stop blood in a hurry. Okay, so these are the three steps, all right, broken down into these different pathways. There's an extrinsic pathway, right, which is the usual way coagulation starts, right? And here is an intrinsic pathway that can happen when we take blood out of somebody, right, that kind of bypasses some of these extrinsic pathways, but they all end up with this final common pathway right here. Okay, so this first step, prothrombin activator formation, the formation of an active factor 10, okay, and these factors were named pretty much in the order that they were discovered in, all right, so factor 1 was discovered before factor 2, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what does factor 10 really do? We see a molecule here called prothrombin. And this is similar to a molecule fibrinogen in the sense that, what can you tell me about fibrinogen? It's inactive. Whenever you see that O-gen at the end of a word, that means it's inactive. But there is, what, a huge concentration in the blood ready to be converted into fibrin at a moment's notice. And this is a structural protein that forms that net. It's not an enzyme. Now, prothrombin right here is also inactive. And how do I know it's inactive? It doesn't have an O-gen at the end of it, but it has a prefix. It has pro, right? So this is a proenzyme. It is inactive, but it's ready to go to work at a moment's notice. It can be converted into thrombin, all right? And so the pro right here means that it is an enzyme that is inactive, but it can be converted into an active form very quickly. And what's the thing that activates prothrombin, converting it into thrombin? Calcium, some phospholipids, and blood factor 10, all right? And factor 10 was what? Prothrombin activator. So does that make sense? Prothrombin activator converts prothrombin to thrombin, all right? And thrombin is an enzyme that converts a soluble form of fibrin, which is fibrinogen, into an insoluble form that forms that network, which is what we call fibrin. So fibrin precipitates out of solution, makes that net, makes that fibrin polymer right there that forms a blood clot. So in other words, coagulation is the same thing as making a blood clot. Okay. So coagulation is in a molecular level, what is coagulation? It is fibrin formation. It's not an antibody-antigen reaction. What is an antibody-antigen reaction? That is agglutination, having to do with different blood groups. Okay. So what else do I want you to see about this particular process right here? Calcium is important. Phospholipids are important. And if somebody is deficient in producing some of these clotting factors, which are produced mostly in the liver, then they will have, what, decreased clotting function and a tendency to bleed. And as a matter of fact, some people have a genetic predisposition to that, and we call that hemophilia. Hemophiliacs don't produce a factor 8. All right, so here is factor 8. And since they can't produce factor 8, they can't produce proper amounts of prothrombin activator, which means they can't make thrombin, this enzyme that converts fibrinogen to fibrin. So hemophiliacs could bleed to death just as a result of a little paper cut on their finger. Okay? So that's a terrible condition. So what do they need? Transfusions, in particular, or shots of what? Factor 8 right here. Now, another interesting thing that I see on this diagram is that thrombin not only acts on fibrinogen to make fibrin to form a clot, but thrombin can also act and activate within the intrinsic pathway the conversion of factor 11 into an active 11, which does what? Activates, what is that, 15? Is that 15? What is this? 9. Oh, because you subtract 1 from 10 right here. All right, and factor 9 does what? It makes prothrombin activator. So what do we call that, okay, when thrombin not only makes fibrin, but it helps activate this intrinsic pathway? All right, so the response right here is thrombin, okay, which enhances intrinsic factor pathway, all right, which does what? Produces more thrombin, which stimulates the intrinsic pathway, which produces more thrombin, okay? That is a nice positive feedback mechanism. All right, so now this little side diagram is not in your textbook, so you might want to draw it in if it's not on your slide. So, and this is a normal everyday occurrence, right? So here is another example of a healthy positive feedback mechanism that does what? Basically, it speeds up coagulation so that prevents or limits hemorrhage. So this is a necessary step under normal circumstances to prevent hemorrhage in people. And you've probably heard of heparin, which is an anticoagulant. Heparin blocks thrombin's action on this intrinsic pathway right here, so this reduces clotting function in people. Right? So heparin is a nice anticoagulant because it blocks this step. All right, so these three steps are what? Prothrombin activator formation. Prothrombin activator converts prothrombin into thrombin, and then thrombin is an enzyme that converts fibrinogen into fibrin in a hurry, which then forms a blood clot that looks like this right here. So here are all the blood factors. All right, so factor 4 is calcium. All right, and you don't have to memorize all these things, but it's probably just handy to look over what some of these factors are. Some are enzymes, some are cofactors, like this calcium is a cofactor. But the bottom line I want you to know is what? Coagulation is the production of fibrin, and it's produced by a cascade mechanism, right? Even with some positive feedback so that it happens in a hurry, and you need proper levels of some metabolites like all those clotting factors that are produced by the liver, and some ions like calcium. Okay, so that's pretty important. So that's the only thing I want you to know about this diagram. This might be an exam figure with just a few of these things canceled out. Like what? Maybe this positive feedback maybe was canceled out that you have to label. Maybe calcium I blotted out, so you have to know calcium is important, and phospholipids, and maybe this is blotted out if anybody's looked at that exam figure. But you don't have to understand all of these steps, but you should just at least know that it's what? A cascade mechanism that happens very quickly. Okay. All right. Well, as you know from various other systems, for instance, when you want to flex the forearm, there's a muscle that flexes the forearm, but to have nice precise control over your forearm, what else do you need besides a biceps and brachialis and brachioradialis for flexion? What do you need? You need the triceps, which extends the forearm. And what do you call those muscle groups? What's the relationship between those muscle groups? They're antagonistic to each other, right? Okay. Well, do you think that maybe you should have good antagonistic control over fibrin formation as well? Because one of really terrible things that can happen to somebody if, instead of just at the site of a injury to a blood vessel, fibrin forms, right? Instead of that happening, fibrin forms all over their body. So what's going to happen to their whole body? It's going to form a blood clot. And then what's going to happen? Well, that's it, right? Then you're dead. So that's a coagulopathy. That's a disseminated intravascular coagulopathy that happens to people every once in a while. For instance, if they really have a damaged liver and maybe are suffering from other kinds of maladies at the same time, very difficult to control. The outcome is usually pretty poor, and people are very excited when that happens because somebody's about ready to die. But it's really difficult to manage those kinds of coagulopathies. So there are processes, natural processes in the body to limit the extent of fibrin formation and even to break a clot down after a wound is healed. So you don't need to have a blood clot in your body after the wound is healed. All right, so here's a mechanism that is antagonistic to coagulation. It will break clots down. All right, so when the damage is repaired, activated factor 12 right here causes activation of something we call kallikrein. And kallikrein works on plasminogen. What can you tell me about plasminogen? It's at relatively high concentrations in your body, but what is it doing normally? Nothing. It's sitting around, right? And you know it's doing nothing because why? We see ogen, but kallikrein is an enzyme that converts plasminogen into plasmin, and the job of plasmin is to digest fibrin. It dissolves blood clots after a wound is healed. But it also limits the extent of clot formation when it's normally happening in your body so that a blood clot only forms at that site of a particular injury. Okay, so that's particularly interesting. People use plasminogen, for instance, if they want to dissolve a blood clot artificially in people. When might you want to dissolve a blood clot? Maybe somebody's experiencing a stroke. Maybe somebody has a blood clot in the brain. Okay, or maybe a pulmonary embolism. Somebody is having a blood clot in their lungs, or maybe a blood clot in their heart, and it's blocking blood supply to a part of the heart, brain, or lung. And what's going to happen to that part of the brain or heart or lung if it can't get oxygen? It dies, right? So people thought of a way, well, let's give some plasmin or some activators for plasmin, and let's dissolve those clots so that those tissues can be reperfused, and then it will spare them that kind of injury and death. So some people are given a tissue plasminogen activator, TPA. There's a compound that bacteria make called streptokinase that can dissolve blood clots, and then the parts of the brain become revascularized. But some sophisticated diagnostics have to be done first to find out why somebody is having a stroke. A stroke is when blood is not reaching a part of the brain, but it could be due to two things. What could it be due to? A clot that blocks the blood vessel, but there could be another reason. How about if a blood vessel has an aneurysm and the aneurysm breaks, right? So now blood is not going through that blood vessel due to bleeding in the brain. All right? Would you want to give plasmin or a plasmin activator to somebody that's having bleeding in the brain? What would that do to the bleeding? It would make it worse, right? So you have to diagnose, why is somebody having a stroke? Is it due to a clot or due to a bleed? If it's due to a clot, maybe you can reduce the clot with a plasmin activator. But if they're bleeding, that's the last thing you want to give them, because that will make bleeding what? Much worse as a result. So some fancy kinds of imaging studies have to be done fast. But how do they have to be done? In a hurry, right? They have to be done in a hurry. You can't wait around. So if you have a family member, right, that has like a transient ischemic attack, they forget where they are, what their name is, what they're doing, okay? Don't let it pass. Don't let them say, oh, you know, I'll be better in 5 minutes or a half hour. Or if somebody's experiencing a heart attack, don't let them say, oh, you know what, it might go away in 5 minutes or a half hour. What's the best thing to do? Get them to a good hospital like Memorial over there in Long Beach, and they can diagnose what's happening and maybe even prevent a full-blown stroke or heart attack before it happens, right? So be a little aggressive in that. So we're going to start here with anticoagulants next time, but you know something about that already. You do.